Bruce is here for Sports Lit 101, and I know you're excited to talk about this book. It sounded great in the summary, and it's living up to that billing.
Yeah, and it's sort of is a bridge over troubled waters in some sense.
Mm.
It's by a guy named Jim Leake, who's written 19 books, and a number of them on matters to do with the First World War and matters to do with baseball. And this book, which combines the two, it's called From the Dugouts to the Trenches, and we're lucky we got an expedited copy from University of Nebraska Press. I learned a lot in this book that I did not know. I mean, there were certain things that I did know, but what I found really fascinating was how quickly baseball embraced the idea that it could suspend, if it needed to, operations for a couple of years because it was more important that baseball players be involved in the Great War and in the war effort, including older players working in the shipyards and the like. And I can't imagine that happening now. I just somehow cannot imagine the owners of professional sports teams saying, oh, well, we'll close the whole thing down for a couple of years. Now, during the war, the minor leagues basically did close during World War.
Mm.
The last 2 years, 1917, 1918, they were basically done. A number of them tried to survive. But what's interesting are these great magnates, the names that we recognize from early baseball, Charles Comiskey, Jacob Rupert, Harry Frazee, who doesn't come off so well in the book, Connie Mack, were all faced with this challenge. They needed to find a way to do two things. To not have their players appear as slackers.
Mm.
We had a draft, as people may remember, World War I, the draft was reinstituted, and able-bodied men were being called up. You could avoid military service if you were involved, as I think this is the case now, in what was considered an absolutely essential national defense-related industry, if you were doing something that had to be done. But what they started doing was literally drilling. They got most of the baseball teams hired sergeants from local military bases to drill their teams for up to 2 hours a day during spring training. At the same, they didn't cut the time that they were training down for baseball. And they really, really got behind the war effort, particularly Till Houston, who was Jacob Rupert's partner with the Yankees, who at age 50, and as the book describes, a portly man not in great shape, went over and became one of the key engineers in building the railroads that carried all the supplies. But the interesting part of the baseball part of this is that baseball went on in Europe during the whole war, that wherever players could play, they played, and that the French became enamored with the game, and that every shipyard had a team, and every kind of organization you could imagine, industrial plants had teams, and many of them were stocked in part with these professional players, generally the older guys in their late 30s who were near the end of their careers, or guys who for one reason or another had some physical limitation, eyesight perhaps, that relegated them to playing baseball at a lower level. Now, what's interesting about this, too, this is the time when the Star Spangled Banner starts getting played at every sporting event. Began at Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park and Comiskey Park.
And it began to honor the veterans who had returned from Europe.
Right. The veterans who had come back from Europe were all asked to stand, and then the people would stand, and the band would play the national anthem. Prior to that, there were times when it would be played, but it wasn't part of the fabric of what baseball did. The other interesting thing that was taking place where this becomes important is how later years, for World War II and Korea particularly, if a player was exempted from military service due to an injury, the amount of abuse they took was phenomenal. Mickey Mantle being one of them, who was twice tried to sign up. And twice was rejected because of a knee injury. And he was called a commie and a slacker and abused. It was really this notion in World War I that baseball was America's pastime and America's a patriotic nation that caught me a little bit more by surprise. There's some interesting stories about, you know, really great players who played. A guy named Hank Gowdy was a hell of a ball player. Mm. He gave up a good portion of his career to be in combat right at the front lines, liked being there, enjoyed being that part of the war. Something I didn't know, which Rich did know, that Christy Mathewson's baseball career was severely limited because he was involved in a, in a, um, uh, an exercise where they were going to learn to use their gas masks, and some idiot didn't bother to tell people it was live gas. Mathewson, eight men died, and Mathewson and another ball player inhaled enough gas to be injured, and Mathewson's lungs were weak after that, and he died very young. He was only 39, I think.
The great Grover Cleveland Alexander suffered a pretty serious injury, had a shell go off, and lost his hearing, or a part of his hearing, and also believed in later years that it contributed to his epilepsy, which he sort of self-medicated with alcohol.
Yes, and that's a really compelling part of the story in here. The number of soldiers who came back suffering from what we would call PTSD today, but at the time was called shell shock, and was considered, if you were shell shocked, you were considered to be a coward.
Oh yeah, sign of weakness.
Sign of weakness. You weren't tough enough. Some of these guys would have survived a shell exploding in a group of people, and everybody else is maimed or dead, and they're not, and so they're a little shocked by that and torn up. And that happened to a number of baseball players. 1,200 professional baseball players, sports writers, and baseball executives served in World War I.
Wow.
And the number of minor leaguers whose careers, I mean, never became major leaguers, not just as a result of being injured in the war but the time they missed, the time away from the game, is really pretty amazing.
And especially when you consider that we were only involved in the war for a year and a half.
Yeah, basically 2 years tops. And the interesting thing is that so many of them left their teams and then were put in these long training programs because it wasn't, we know World War I to be a war of attrition, but it wasn't really until the final push that they needed that many Americans.
Right.
So that a lot of these guys arrived at the very last minute or didn't and didn't see combat. And another thing I'd never heard this before, and I've read a lot of books about World War I, was that the German resolve was crumbling when they knew how many more Americans there were in the pipeline. I'd never heard that. Mm. It was nothing I'd ever studied. That gets mentioned a little in here. What's really interesting is the way people got behind they would decide to raise money to send a baseball equipment over to France for the troops. They'd raise like $5,000 at a game where it was 50 cents to get in.
Hmm.
That people really, I guess, understood that a lot of the morale issues were solved by familiarity, if there were familiar things to do. And there was a lot of debate as to whether baseball should have shut down, should just closed it down, said to hell with it. You know, that debate we always have in those kinds of things. Are we better off? Should Pete Rozelle have played football after JFK was assassinated? I mean, I think most people now say, no, you could have called those games off. At the time, the thought was, if you do that, have you given in to this kind of thing? I mean, and there's a lot of that in here, but what's incredible is how well-researched this is. I had the number on top of my head and then I forgot it. Let me see here. I have the number of pages of notes. There are somewhere around almost 40 pages of end notes that go with this that lead you to a lot of great other great resources. But what's nice is it's not written like an academic book. It's written like a memoir. It's really very good. And it goes in chronological order. There's some fantastic pictures in here. Fantastic photographs of Harry Hooper convincing striking players to take the field for Game 5 of the 1918 World Series, which almost didn't get played over money. Pictures of Charles Schwab, who tried to corner the Industrial League, what was known as the Shipyard League, the shipping yard teams, by trying to pull in all the professional players he could get. I mean, it's interesting stuff.
And let's not forget either, with a lot of players serving, some teams had fewer than others, one of them the Red Sox, and that may have been one of the factors in them winning the World Championship in 1918.
Yeah, Harry Frazee's stocking of that team and the number of those players who miraculously got furloughed from the shipyard to play is the subject of some derisive comments from Mr. Leake. It's interesting. Frazee he comes off as a guy who, A, had his interests ahead of the country's. People are going to be suspicious because they know I'm a Yankees fan, but read the book. You're not going to like Harry Frazee any more than you did for trading us Babe Ruth.
Right.
Just not a really a nice guy, but that 1918 team with Babe Ruth, is when you look at that, what happened, they had more major league players than the other teams, and that made a big difference. And the Cubs were a little bit that way too. They weren't quite the way Comiskey was. So, you know, maybe a lot of what happened to those two teams was karma that goes back to World War. They had to wait a long time to win again.
Yeah, exactly. And Jim Leake, the author of the book, is going to be with us in a couple of weeks.
Yes, on the 28th, he will be with us. I'm really looking forward to that. He's very excited to come on and talk about the book. So it's called From the Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War, from the University of Nebraska Press, and Leake is L-E-E-K-E.
And also, in terms of guests on the segment, we have Doug Branson coming up as well.
We don't know when yet. Yeah, Doug Branson, who wrote Greatness in the Shadows. We don't know exactly when yet. I'm guessing that I'll hear from them pretty soon. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to them.